is on now. Hi, so yes, I'm speaking. Thank you. I thought I was going to come at 1400
Vėliau, antrą valandą, bet dabar galiu kalbėti ir dabar, suprantu,
nesu
dar visiškai pasirengęs, bet turiu 60 skaidrių.
Thanks, I would like to thank the organizers. I also like to thank organizatoriams, the Open Society Institute,
atviros visuomenės institutui, kuris mane finansavo mano kelionę.
Jamesui Griffinui,
kuris su manimi bendradarbiavo rengiant pastarąjį mano darbą, mokslinį
darbą. Dabar
kalbėsiu apie autorių
identifikavimą. Topic. But before ir I want to do this, let me make a little bit of a remark about today's day. Today is the Valentine's Day, right?
And there's a
myth associated with the Valentine's Day, you know, that man and woman will fall in
mitas,
love. It is a very emotional and irrational experience, but it's supposed
diena,
to be staying in this, right? So that people go in this irrational state, they're going to be staying in it.
And I'm a little bit
in a similar way, my life mirrors that, you know, I have a look for my life, which is sort of, you know, collection and care of academic data and and I've been in that state on the love of my life for a very long time. So I've been doing things that are sort of long run, and I may bore you with stuff that is somewhat historic, right? But just like there is a historic context to what I do. I mean, just like lovers, essentially, you know, in their Valentine's myth, reproduce behaviors that their parents have seen. My passion for sharing the data doesn't really come along, right? It's on its own, in the academic world, right, there has been a long tradition of building a common framework of Newman knowledge and to share the discoveries widely, right? So generally, academics do not sell access to the research papers. They give them available, make them available for free, right? And as an economist, I'm a trained economist, so I know the price of everything and the value of nothing. But since the 1990s, I've been astounded that, you know, academics gave the contents away and scientific journals were, at least at their times, were expensive and inconvenient. They're still expensive, but they're less inconvenient than they were in the 1990s, okay? But there has been a lot of talk about this, right? I believe it's an irrational system, but it is obscured by the fact that it has been going on for a very long time. So the irrationality of the system is obscured by that, that it's just, you know, things like people usually, you know, they think backwards, they see, they reproduce things that have been done in the past, and so they don't really think that this is a rational behavior or not. Today, incidentally, is also the 10th anniversary of the Budapest Online Initiative. So what I do really comes always in the conscience of open access and sharing of data, right? So my general inspiration for the work that I've been doing has been the open software movement, right? So ideally, you know, human knowledge should be like a set of open source software. And it's something that Mike has already related to. He said, you know, I ideally would like to have something which, a system where the scientific discovery is rather than in bits and pieces called papers, right? It's going to be spread across a set of documents and will be more easier navigable than the molecular paper structure that we currently have. And I'm working on making this sort of free things freely available. But while we cannot really have this sort of software structure to our current stage of the human knowledge, we can certainly build something that is like a database structure for metadata about that knowledge. And that's where I've been mainly doing my work in, right? As I said, I'm a trained economist, and I did my work on scholarly communication, mainly in the domain of economics, between about 1993, and I continue to do work within the economics discipline. And economists are interesting because, you know, while you're thinking that they're always thinking commercial terms, they actually do have a system that allows them to distribute their work in a non-commercial basis, and that's the working paper system. So it's basically just recent accounts of research being done in institutions, and they're circulated to other institutions on a on an exchange base. So I'll show you mine, you show me yours. In the old paper days, they were circulated in print and then stored in the coffee room, right, which is not exactly the best way of making sure that everybody is aware of the latest work being done, right? And so I've been doing work, 1990s, I became aware of the internet, and I've been doing work to try to preserve this this infrastructure and bring it into the internet age, right? And at that time, I created a project called NetTech, and I published the first online working paper in economics in 1993, right? Other people did other work in this area. There were attempts to emulate the success of the physics archive which at the time was called xxx.lanl.gov, right? In economics, and the system was created by Bob Parks, right? And so my idea was that things should be done in a decentralized way, that institutions should continue to publish the working papers on an institutional basis. Bob thought that moving to a model as physics have it would be the better idea. And generally, I think, you know, my ideas overall won, but we created a system that is both centralized and decentralized, right? So the idea is that institutions will be building institutional repositories, that these repositories, however, the data about this repository would be able to be harvested, and they would be acting in such a way that common sets of user services could be built across institutional repositories. And that was a structure built in the 1997 at a time when, you know, the word institutional repositories wasn't even really there yet. It's only started in about in the early 2000s, really. The motivation behind that was really, you know, make economics papers freely available and make information about these papers available. So it's both data, think about papers, and metadata, right? And these two things work jointly together, right? So we're not in REPIC, we're not limited to making information only about freely available papers available. We document everything that has been done, right? The other thing is there's always been trying to keep a self-sustaining infrastructure so we don't rely on external funding, right? Because if we do, then the effort is going to be collapsing at some stage, right? So we've always been trying to work on a shoestring budget and get people involved essentially as volunteers, okay? So the resulting system is called REPIC. It's often misunderstood as a repository, yeah, but in fact it is a collection of about, you know, over 1,300 institutional subject-based repositories, right? And they're furnishing data about papers and sometimes the papers themselves to the system. Now, how come that this system has been so successful, right? There are basically two types of sources for that success, I think, right? Reels and for the sales can't be directly observed. But if there's a business case and there's a technical matter, right? So the idea of the business case is really that we're trying to decentralize as much as we can, that we'll rely on volunteer power and that we encourage the reuse of REPIC data. And I think the latter case, part is particularly important, right? And there's also a technical case that we've been building a technical infrastructure, and that technical infrastructure has been sustaining the entire effort, and that's where the link comes in with author registration, right? Because we have an author registration service within within REPIC, which is REPIC author service, which I'll be calling RAS in from onwards. We also have an institutional registration in the EDIRC system. All right, and the key to all of this is the last point, that we're using these data to produce evaluative data that evaluates both authors and institutions. So we can build rankings for authors and institutions from combining the bibliographic data with these data that we have about the authors and the institutions, right? For the institutional registration, it's only done by one single person, Christian Zimmermann, right? So he started by creating a list of all economics departments that have web page, and since all departments now have a web page, he's pretty much registered most institutions in the world, right? And there's the registration of authors. Now, the registration of authors can't be done by one single person, so I created what is now known as the REPIC Author Service in 1999, and I had the money from JISC allowed me to hire somebody to do the actual coding on this, right? So when somebody comes to that service, they're creating an initial registration, right? So the authors gives some personal information, such as the email address, the names, and name variations, which is ways in which the name may be written, right? So, and then from these name variations, we assume that a paper that carries that name variation matches the author, if it matches one of the name variations that appear on document, matches the name variation of the author, it may be a paper written by that author, and we allow the author to claim or disclaim the paper, right? Okay. Registrants can also create institutional affiliations, right? So they can search the IDIRC database, right, for names of institutions they work at. When a matching institution is found, then they can add this institution, right? There's also a way of proposing new institutions, right, so that when an author doesn't find an institution, the author can propose an institution. The items are entered as string data in the profile, and then they're being officialized later. So if this is really a new institution that hasn't been there, or the it's just not an institution that the author has been not been found. And we can add this set of institutional data, and that's one of the ways we're actually growing our institutional data set over time, right? So at the second stage of when the users work with this RIPAC author service, that's really the heart of they can claim and disclaim papers, and there's also an email alertion service for new matching papers, right? The system has been a rather stunning success. There's about 40,000 authors registered. To give you an idea, the American Economic Association, which is the largest professional organization, economists, has about 8,000 members, so roughly. Another assessment can come from an independent list of about the top 2,000 authors in economics. Over 80% are registered. That list has been done 10 years ago. Obviously, some of these people who were on that list have died and will no longer register. So we're not going to be able to reach 100% with this. Okay. What's the reason for this success? Well, we've been collecting a lot of data, right? Download data, citations data, classification data, and we're building rankings for this. So we're ranking economists, and you can only climb the ranking if you claim papers, right? If you haven't got any papers, you're not going to get any ranking, right? Okay, so the idea for me has been then over the years, you know, is there a way to build some sort of a similar REPEC structure to REPEC for all disciplines? And that's obviously a very, very large project in which I've been making some way forward. First of all, for that, we really need a bibliographic data set, and we need an author claiming service, and we need an institutional data set, okay? Let me give you a little bit of theory about author identification, which this is about the second part of my talk. Generally, when we're talking about author identification, we have a situation where there were documents, okay? Where there are authors who wrote the documents, and the authors are identified when we know really what person wrote what document, right? So that's a simple theory. Now, of course, in that theory, I set some limitations. I will deliberately ignore the fact that there are relationships other than authorship, right, which I'm going to be leaving aside. And I'm also not going to be interested in the relationship between authors and document collections, right, which I'm leaving out for the moment, right? So currently the stage is that on documents, authors are referenced by name expressions, right? And there isn't any universal identification scheme for persons that we could piggyback on, and if we could just simply ask the authors to quote that system, right? So the ultimate solution of author identification is really the issue of author identification is somewhat a temporary problem, right? The ultimate solution would be we have a government-backed identification scheme that becomes widely available across nations, right? So the example, the U.S. Social Security number, right, that would be generalized across countries, and we wouldn't be having problems with ID theft, which is mainly a problem in the United States anyway, with identity theft, right? Contrasting this situation, but we're here, we're having our name strings, right, and we're over there, we'll see something that comes up, you know, in the distant future where we have all humans are going to be identified with some sort of a code. Clearly, the name references are clearly insufficient, but the insufficiency is unevenly distributed, right? So it's, you know, for Krichel isn't all that bad. For Chen or Smith, it really is bad, right? And It is also a problem when the bibliographic data does not contain full names, which is the case of many large bibliographic data sets. For example, PubMed only introduced full author names in 2002. Pre-2002 data does not have such a data set, right? Now, we can try to extract context data from documents where name variations occur, and we'll try to disambiguate these sets. The authors. And so we can then build sets of documents that have that assumed to have been written by the same author, and we can call that author name disambiguation, right? So disambiguation is not the same thing as author identification, right? So because the system is a disambiguation scheme will be done by a machine only, right? So since it's done machine only, it's rather error prone, as Mike has already told us, right? So generally we can think about the author identification when the identity is confirmed by a trustworthy person. Now, who is more trustworthy than a librarian? All right. Okay. Librarians have been building operating system authority control for many years. Right. Basically, authority control means that we decide what for each person what variant of the name is authorized, and then use the authorized form for all occurrences of that person. Now, but here's the problem with this, right? When we talk about author identification, I said we have a pile of documents, we have a pile of people. But what about this pile of documents? How are we going to be identifying? What is in the pile of documents? So we can call that the corpus, right? Okay. So what's the corpus? In the library, it's okay. It's basically the stuff that the library has collected, right? Okay. Apart from the periodicals. The periodicals have never been identified in terms of contents, but in general, this thing is. So it works in terms of, you know, the library doing work for the local collection, and if you have a set of cataloging stuff, you can do this. There's also the possibility of working with OCLC on shared cataloging, and libraries have been doing a lot of work in this area, and I'm sure Jennifer is going to be telling us more about this. So I'm going to skip over this a little bit. But it said in 1999, here comes in RAS. So 1999, it was the first time that authors get involved in actual author identification, right? So it was also the first identification system for periodicals contents, because much of what the bibliographic corpus of WebPack is about is actual bibliographic data that talks about articles and working papers, so not about so much about books, right? Okay, so back comes with our elephants. So the reason the corpus in RepEG is really the RepEG database. So it's okay. It's something that we can relatively widely understand, right? But in terms of building an author claiming system that is universal across a number of subjects, right? There are basically two approaches, right? We can deal with what my friend Jim wants to do is we can create a bunch of claiming systems. Authors who works in certain areas will go ahead and claim with that system. And then there is an overarching system that can bring different claims together, right? Okay. My approach at the moment is really work on a vast bibliographic data set and have authors claiming for that data set. And that's the data set I'm currently working on. It's FreeLib, right? And it's a project by the Open Law Society, which is sponsored by the Open Knowledge Foundation. I'm going to talk about to them because I hope that they're going to be getting more involved into maintaining FreeLib, because this is basically their primary business. About at the moment, well, actually 45, that's right. Is it more over 40 million records, right? PubMed, the Open Library, DBLP, RepEG, there's some institutional repository data that I'm reading into this. But the data is actually very simple. It contains titles, author name expressions, and link to a page on the provider's site, right? And the idea of FreeLib is to meant to serve author claim, and author claim is an author claiming system that I built on all of those. It lives at authorclaim.org, and it used the same software as the RepEG author system called AKIS, which was subsidized by the Open Society Institute. And I've been running this since about early 2008, right? So the advantage of this is, of running a system like AuthorClaim is that we have a robust and simple design. We can make the bulk data freely available, right? And we're avoiding authors working with different claiming system, as would be the case in the scenario that Jim has. Hey, there are some limitations to author claim. First of all, it is an author claiming rather than a pure author identification, right? Pure author claiming is not the same thing as author identification, right? And the difference between author claiming and author identification is what I call Clink's problem, right? So basically, in author claiming, you as an author say that you are one of the authors of a paper, right? Which does not say which of the authors you are, right? So there is a subtle difference, right? So the example, you know, have Jane and John Smith, they write a paper, and the author list says J. Smith and J. Smith. Then we don't know if John Smith or Jane Smith has been the first author. Right. So it's now usually this isn't so much of a problem part because we can still use name disambiguation for this issue, but it's clearly there is a theoretical gap between claiming and identification. Okay. Now the other limitation of author claim is that in it has been purposefully constructed in such a way that it is really in its isolation it's useless. Right. So it is a system that really is it produces machine readable data. And that data is supposed to be used by others, right? So it's a purely type of open system in this way, right? And as such, at the moment, it hasn't grown all that much, right? Because, you know, you have a chicken and egg problem, right? You got the problem that, you know, you have a small number of authors and that have registered with the system. More authors will be registered if the system is widely, the records are more widely used, but we're not going to start using the record widely if the system... If the other participants are not going to use those records if the records are small, right? So this is but here's an example of such a thing, right? Jeff Builder's record here is basically, it creates an identification. It says which name variations he has. He says what author he's of, and he says which papers he doesn't have any connections to. Meaning that these are people that are Jeff Builder's, but that's not the Jeff Builder he is, right? So we're publishing not only the data about the papers that a person has claimed, but also about the papers that the person has rejected, right? And this is actually important because we would like to encourage machine learning. We have data from people who have claimed certain papers and have disclaimed others, we can use that data for machine learning in order to sort a list of papers so which we don't know the statute between the papers that are most likely to be claimed from this person and papers that are most likely to be disclaimed by this person because they've been done by another person. Okay? Generally, that work fills itself, ideally, the business model, into the work of institutional repositories. Right. Generally, institutional repositories don't do author identification. They can delegate this to a system like author claim, and author claim can be used then to create links between institutional repositories. It can also be used, you know, to maintain profile pages for the author on the institutional repositories. Well, local links could go to the papers that are in the repository. And other the remote links could be going to other institutional repositories where there are papers available either by that person or by the co-authors of these people. Right? Generally, you know, we would be thinking an institutional repository is too small to be doing much of meaningful claiming for authors in that repository. Okay, so that really is pretty much as I thought I was going to be saying. Yeah.
Thank you so much. Now the talk is open for questions and discussions. Okay. Then I have a question about identification.
Yep.
Identification. Actually, it seems to be a simple approach to provide every author with a specific, unique ID number. And we could submit these ID numbers by submitting our publications, like we indicate our real names. And then you can process all these data much easier. Why we do not have these such identification numbers up to now?
The reason for that is that it's the author would have to create that identification for themselves. They would have to keep that identification constant, right? That is a problem. So, you know, I mean, I see my dad, you know, he has already four times installed himself with a new version of Skype, and every time he changes his ID, that will be leading to somewhere that, you know, it, it, you know, the reusing. So there's also the fact that publishers have not been asking for this type of ID. The ID could also only really be, in order to remain constant, it would have to be issued by some sort of central authority. And it's not easy for the central authority to do the work to check that the person who has done the person is the same constant person, because on the internet nobody knows that you're a dog, right? So they're not gonna be able to run that. So it's a matter of economics, right? The question is, you know, you could potentially run such a system technically, but it would become relatively complicated to run over time, and then the question is, you know, how are you going to be maintaining it?
Yeah.
So, but this is something that ORCID is supposed to provide. Now, in terms of what the most useful feature that I would see for ORCID would be to unify various claiming systems, right? So that the system that I have in Orphic Claim could be, you know, an input to ORCID, and people could be uniting various IDs that they have across a bunch of systems. And that could include things like Facebook or, you know, ResearchGate or whatever, or LinkedIn or whatever, other systems that are beyond academia but still relevant sometimes to academic work.
Thank you. Please, your question.
Just a quick comment that some countries have decided to do that. Brazil is an example. So every researcher, every student there gets a number, and it's sort of a government system, and it's mandatory. There's some other countries, but I think it's not a solution for everybody in the world. I mean, countries like United States, Germany, they're very chaotic. They would never introduce a central system like this. Lithuania might be different. But it's just not a solution to the problem for everybody, I believe.
Yeah. Any other questions? Please.
A follow-up comment to what he said. So I think definitely one size doesn't fit all. And I think it's marvelous how you made things work in your community with economics over, 10-15 years now. But I don't see that approach necessarily working, for example, in our area. It's just too big, too diverse. And that's why, and from reason why I'm not pointing, for example, people to AutoClaim. I don't think it'll sort of fit that particular size. Whereas I see ORCID as more of a unifying force, as I said, and as you said yourself, for many, many different kinds of more customized author ID schemes.
Yeah, I mean, the question is, you can say, you know, it's too large of a project. You can claim, you know, it's not going to take off, because the other alternative is to do claiming on distributed systems. Right, because the main problem with author claiming or author identification at the moment isn't really the question that a system of identification can't be built on an existing database of papers. It's to produce the database of papers initially and make that database freely available. It's a serious problem, right? As in the absence of the UI system becoming freely available, it's a serious issue. Yeah.
I also mentioned this as kind of a non-technical thing. The fact that we have this emerging sort of organization, which, yes, is expensive, as you said, and slow moving, just pointing people in that direction and telling them and showing them something that has a good chance of becoming sustainable is somehow, I mean, people tend to trust that notion better than if you point them to you. You're the one person who runs all the claim. It's kind of it's cheap and all that and independent, but that's got its drawback as well in terms of trust you.
I agree. No, that's, I mean, you know, that to have an established organization is absolutely a way forward. I'm not saying it is wrong. Okay. Sure.
Do we have more questions? Please use the microphone.
You just mentioned about a possibility libraries have already. Maybe it could be an idea just to develop the cooperation with libraries. They have an author name and works and country, all these most important items. Just not to create something new, but work with libraries. What do you think?
Yeah, libraries have data that is authority control data, Unfortunately, authority control data isn't freely available. Right, so it's not in bulk, right? So it's and it mainly concerns books, right? It would not the approach that is in authority control would not scale to the amount of papers that you'd be having in a system that's going to be covering all of science.
Thank you. Any other questions? If not, let's thank the speaker again.
Okay, and it's yours.